soon, till my horse tired through darts and balloons, till I won. And I drank all the lemonade, drove bumper cars, till it seemed like I owned the whole bar. And wherever I went, well, I shook every hand. I said, welcome to my wonderland. I said, welcome to our wonderland.
The Rule Book and Calendar of Kittery Embers. Chapter 13, The Dropsied Skin. Kittery stood upon her grandfather's back. There was a relieving smallness all through her now, a nearness of all things. The trees at the forest edge and the star frost brushed the surface of her eyes. The chilled wooden fragrance of the earth was dense and close. The airy wind ruffled the distant branches inside her head. In the glow of the white rain that wrapped her wrist, Kittery stared down at her grandfather's face. He was quiet now on the ground, sleeping on his belly, his face turned to a side. When she tried to step from his back, her feet swam into the earth. She walked along his legs, but it was the same all around. Her feet would not touch the ground. Her grandfather's body was like a tiny island in the center of an empty sea that she was stranded upon. She leaned over his face with a curious memory. There had been something like this from before. A memory from long ago, just like this, from before the time she'd moved to the swamp with her parents. It seemed impossible to her that she'd ever stood upon her grandfather, but the memory stretched through her body with the roots of recognition. He had been sleeping, just like this, and it was the first time she'd seen the family resemblance. Her mother's fine mouth and wide eyes revealed upon his otherwise turbulent face the downy touch of red in his silver hair, the upper lip like a skirt pinched to either side, and the gully of wrinkles departing the edge of his eyes. Kittery had the same crease developing, although infinitely softer. They had driven to her grandfather's house, on the hill above the beach, in the days before they'd moved to the swamp. A ship-like structure of pillars and porticos, with a dark livery of vines crawling over the white boards, like a fishing net, and a twisting level of windowed turrets and masts going back. The lawns and gardens rose in windy greens and greys, like a strange coloured sea. She was in the back seat of the car, pressed to the door by the jumble of luggage. Her father driving, her mother in the seat up front. "The house is very grand," her mother told her as they drove. "And here's a garden, and many fruit trees, and a staff." "He has a staff," her father echoed, glancing at the car's roof, his temporary way of seeing her. "He used to be quite important, a minister of this or that." They drove together in the old black car along a hammered road and saw no other cars or trucks or houses. Kittery stared out the window and worried that she would miss the ocean because the field grass was so high she couldn't see anything but the flicker of chaff. "Soon?" she kept asking. "Soon the sea?" her mother asked. "Or soon grandfather's house?" "Soon the sea," she said, but the answer would be both. She would see them at the same moment. Her parents spoke of her grandfather and the ocean in similar tones and resemblances, as though they were nearly the same thing. The sea was vast and enigmatic, and you could hear it breathe. It was not the land, but held the land in place. When you saw the sea, you filled up with your life. "You sensed the ocean in yourself," her mother told her, as though she should prepare for the sight of such a mirror. They described her grandfather in other terms of endlessness and mystery. A powerful man who had done great things. He not only ruled the land, but was the ruler of her blood. She came from him. She came from the ocean. She was going back to both, going back to where she came from. It seemed to Kittery, and was the promise of her excitement, that when she saw them both, the ocean and her grandfather, she would know what she meant and what the world meant in the same moment with the same answer. Her grandfather, the ocean, the stars, the footsteps of flesh and blood and sea and light that lapped backwards through time. Her sack of toys was shoved in the space behind her father's seat. Crayons and coloured pencils stuck out like odd hair from the top. Her favourite bean-filled animal and her new diary were unreachably buried at the bottom. "While we're away," her mother said, "you could write down everything that happens and draw pictures. When you visit me, you can bring your book and read to me the things you've done and seen. I've written little messages inside as well, one for each day. But don't read them all at once. It'll be like a vacation," Mr. Embers said, suddenly but quietly, glancing at the ceiling. And then her mother turned around in the front seat, as she always did when she needed to tell her something important. "This is serious, Kittery," her mother said. "We would never go to grandfather's otherwise. We would never leave you like that unless we had to, and we do. Your father will have to spend a lot of his time with me." "Short trip away," her father corrected. "And you'll be nestled in with the old minister. Everything taken care of. Full staff. Run of the place. Breakfast in bed, Kittery. You have your very own room with a stupendous view and a desk and table. You'll have the gardens, the sea. There's a beautiful beach. You could walk there every day." Mrs. Embers leaned in closer. "It's not that I don't want you to be with me, Kittery, because I do. Some things need time and quietness, and I'll need many moments to myself to get better, and your father and I will need to talk and settle things." Mrs. Embers scooped a hand over Kittery's cheek and held it, smiling. Both her parents beamed, as though this separation might be considered fine news from the perspective of adventure. "This is because you're still tired?" Kittery asked. "It is," her mother said. "We can't have your mother in bed all the time," Mr. Embers said cheerfully. "We need her up and about, dancing and singing and telling us what to do. Otherwise, how would we ever know when it's time for lunch or bed? Who will say what clothes to wear or books to read or what fun things to do in the evening? Not me." Kittery smiled at this. Not because she was happy, but because they needed her permission. "And I'll be back as often as I can," her father finished. "It's not really such a bad drive. And what country! I'll enjoy going back and forth. No other cars and this old cracked-up road. Just this beautiful land. And going to visit my daughter in a grand house by the sea. Exactly what I'll need. Just try to stop me." Kittery tried to remember a time before this, before the long drive to grandfather's, before her weeks and months in the house by the sea. But her life began in the black car on the Hammond Road. Her mother had given her the knit-yellow yarn bag to bring along whatever she liked. She'd filled it to the soft handles with stuffed animals, her dearest friends. But then how would she draw her pictures? She took everything out and put in the new diary book tied with a string, and a pencil case and a hand sharpener. And then her father had suddenly begun to fill her yellow bag himself with overflow. A great pair of boots, a zippered box from the bathroom, her slippers in beside her toothpaste and hairbrush, until there was hardly any room for animals. "A small one, perhaps," her father said, gazing at the mound of puffy creatures on her bed. "Dossie," Kittery said. "That's who I'd take," he answered. And so she'd grabbed the old bean-filled mouse, with his black eyes glued to the wrong places, and his few remaining whiskers bald at the ends from melting near the fire, and she pushed him in alongside her boots. They drove up and down the troughs and kettles of the hills, and then rose past a small, perfectly circular pond. She rolled down the window when the roof of the house came into view. "The sea is on the far side of the hills," her mother said. "It will be there suddenly, so don't even blink." And there came a moment where Kittery could tell, from the dropped absence in the sky, that something mighty filled the space beyond the cuts of land. The huge driveway bushes were pruned in neat shapes, green torpedoes and cannonballs, and the grass was of a peculiar yellow lightness, as though the ocean air were killing it. And just as they pulled into the cinder circle before the house, Kittery kneeled on her seat and pressed her face out the window to inhale the grain of the sea. The ocean breathed in a thousand places in the air, growing louder until she saw it. A great steely face, packed with jagged eyes. The ocean held itself for a moment between a crack of hill and sky, and then was gone a moment before the car came to a stop. "After lunch," her mother said, "we will all go down to the water, and then your father and I will be off. He'll be back in a week, 7 days, and you can mark those days on the calendar in your diary." Kittery had never before met her grandfather, a grey stranger in a wheelchair on the shadowed porch. "He used to be quite something," her mother said, "but now he's in that chair, and he can do very little. And there will always be plenty of people around, gardeners and nurses and staff. He can hardly move now, and is very old and quite finished as far as anything. As sad as that is, that's why it's good for us now, safe for you, completely safe." As Kittery looked at the wooden circles of his wheelchair and the heavy blanket on his lap, she saw her grandfather raise a crooked arm and sniff the air. "He's waving," she reported. "But was he?" She waved back to see if she could make his arm swing toward her, but he simply lowered the thin limb and looked away. One day she would be an old woman on a porch in a chair like that. Her mother used a chair at home, and her grandfather did. And if they all had the same blood and came from the same ocean, wouldn't they all end up in the same chair? "Here I am," her grandfather announced, as though it was he himself who had just arrived. She stared at her feet and slid them down into the cinders. Her father leapt around the car to fetch the wheelchair from the trunk as an old nurse in a dark uniform glided from the house. Her grandfather was trying to stand. The blanket dropped from his lap. The nurse took him firmly by the shoulders and pushed him down into his chair. But he battled her back with slapping hands and finally ceased. "Who is that?" Kittery asked. "That is your grandfather's nurse," Mr. Embers said. "She lives in the house, in a room beside his, but I don't remember her name. You'll be on the top floor, though, way above them." Her father pointed to a glassy square, enclosed in vines, and smiled at the delightful distance. "I think her name is Biscuits," Mrs. Embers said, settling into her chair, unlocking the brakes. "It's Mrs. Biscuits." And then another man emerged from the house in a fine suit. He stood in a formal position, arms staunchly behind his back, as though he would always be present to observe the difficult work he somehow couldn't do. "That's Mr. Twidbin, your grandfather's secretary," her father said. "And it's Brushes," Mrs. Embers said, as her father began to push her over the stones. "I'm sorry, not Biscuit. It's Mrs. Brushes."
"I've been wondering if the way I'm wondering is the way I make my way back home. Since I've taken all this time, I've wasted all this time just making my way home." home. Hold down steady, there's a hold down ready, there's a hold down ready, that's a home. Hold down steady, there's a hold down ready, there's a hold down ready, that's a home.
I've been wondering if the way I'm wondering is the way I make my way back home. Since I've taken all this time, I've wasted all this time just making my way home.
Hold down steady, there's a hold down ready, there's a hold down ready, that's a home. Hold down steady, there's a hold down ready, there's a hold down ready, that's a home.
I've been wondering if the way I'm wondering is the way I make my way back home. Since I've taken all this time, I've wasted all this time just making my way home.
It certainly was a gloomy room, with all its dripping dark rocks. But Dorsey was nevertheless quite pleased to see it. He felt as though his eyes had been turned off for a very long time. Through the stony walls he could hear a creeping rumble, either the howling wind or the groaning of dirt, it was hard to tell. Which meant they were either in the tipsy top of a castle turret, or deep below the ground. He looked at the peculiar worm around his neck and then upward at the woodpecker above him. Both were sound asleep. Despite this, the great woodpecker maintained a firm grasp on Darcy's neck scruff and held him, very thankfully in fact, above an unpleasant reddish pool. Once again, it was a situation of complete questions and not a single answer. All by himself, Dorsey had never stumbled across the exotic creation of an answer. Follow-up thoughts and expressions that began with, therefore, just didn't come naturally. Dorsey surveyed the room. The bird's free leg was stiffly placed on the corner of a candlelit table. There were two books on the table. Therefore, he said, hoping to burst into theory. But only silent brain noises followed, little squishy cracklings of damp tinder that would never catch fire because there was no spark and because the tinder was never not wet. But he'd certainly slept long enough, hadn't he? His leaky brain boat should be in prime form and capable of at least a minor notion or two. I am going to have a thought, Dorsey thought to himself, not sure if this determination in itself might qualify as such a thing. For example, the poor greenish light. That was easy. The stub of candle was sputtering above the table for a reason. Its wick was so low and spent that all it could do was jostle the room with an on-and-off glow. Therefore, Dorsey concluded with a little shiver, it may soon be dark in here. Completely dark. That was very nearly a thought, wasn't it? On the table lay two nearly identical books. Therefore, Dorsey said, praying again for liftoff. At the very least, he knew he'd seen the books before, been interested in them. But not both. Wasn't that it? In fact,
There shouldn't be two of them, should there? That was a thought. That was a very clear, very apt conclusion, and Dossie smiled at his lack of leaks. Both books were open, easily seen from his on the table, over the puddle, under the bird dangle. Yet every fuzzy word on the visible pages was a reminder that as far as reading was concerned, he might as well be the old worm around his neck, blind from sleep and a thorough lack of eyes. He froze when he saw them, knowing only they were his enemy. Upon the surface of the red liquid floated four treacherous ducks. "I know you," Dossie told them grandly, very pleased to remember the high level of his animosity. "You are all on sticks and wooden as well, and I am very much on to you," Dossie warned them. Also in the bloody awfulness there seemed to be a long, deflated heap of wrinkles, like a saggy old balloon wrapped in rags. "I thought I saw the mouse move," a wet voice called, suddenly from the vaporous dark of the hall. Dossie froze as two figures stepped into view, a little girl and an older woman. "Never mind the mouse," the little girl said. She wore a yellow dress and had a rusted crown upon her reddish hair. They came closer and closer and stood right beside him, and Dossie felt every tiny tip of his fur quiver with the terribleness. "Help me with the trimus, Mrs. Precious," the girl said, and gazed down at the blurry pages of the two books. The older woman, with slick wet lips and eyes like poisoned eggs, lifted the collection of creatures and set them regally down on the girl's shoulder. Dossie almost exploded as the sleeping woodpecker's claws gouged a dripping wound into the girl's shoulder, but the girl herself sighed with relief as though approving the violence. There was a long pause as she examined the pages before her. Dossie took the opportunity to observe the blood dripping from her shoulder directly into the puddle with the horrifying confirmation of no difference. The blood that dripped was the same as what it dripped in. Therefore, Dossie reasoned, it is her blood. "Has the minister stumbled again?" the old woman asked, with a note of eagerness as though she hoped he had. "He has done what we needed, but it looks as though she has broken the glass of the ninth ven." Mrs. Brushes stiffened. "What power did she take?" "If she'd known anything about it," the little girl began, "she might have chosen wiser, but she has taken for herself the power of absolution." "The power of absolution?" Mrs. Brushes said, almost laughing. "In the moment of her transcendence, she must have had the very poor timing to forgive her grandfather." The little girl with the rusty crown laughed. "Did she?" Mrs. Brushes marvelled. "And thus," the monarch said, "Kittery Embers now wields the power of the grass. Mind you, I'm sure the minister is suffering now in the grassy blade of her compassions." The monarch turned slowly, kicking at the baggy, half-submerged form in the puddle. "When you removed my skin and placed me in her body, Mrs. Brushes, I thought we'd come to a certain end, the battle won. I was rejuvenated, young again, a whole new, fresh life to command. I look down upon my old skin floating in this pool, and I feel no connection to it. And then, too, how could she return? She'd been rebuffed to the littoral and Tamerlane with no way of arriving here, but her rule is clear." The monarch leaned over the page and read Kittery's rule aloud. "To find out deepest what's within, wear your oldest, last, and dropsied skin." "She will come for the dropsied skin?" Mrs. Brushes said, her mouth falling wetly open. "She will come for the dropsied skin, Mrs. Brushes. She will try to escape Tamerlane and set my skin upon her sylvan frame, that she may walk amongst us once more.
But we shall keep her where she is. She will never leave the woods of Tamerlane. She will remain as she is, the ghost of a girl. And we shall follow the instructions of my rule." And the monarch shifted across the table and gazed down at her own rule and read it aloud to Mrs. Brushes. "Though three of us entwined and grossed, the one who lives must kill its ghost." "To Tamerlane, then," Mrs. Brushes said, "and finish the job for good." She lifted the Trimus Picus Vermis and set it back on the table edge. Dossie watched as the old woman and the little girl waded into the deeper pool and casually reached out for the pair of wooden ducks that paddled toward them, beaks snapping. Two spouts of blood shot into the air as the ducks took them down into the pool. Dossie didn't know what or why, only that something must be done, and now. But what? If his leaky brain boat couldn't provide the answer, there was something else that could. "Whiskers!" Dossie shouted to his whiskers. "What is the something that must be done?" For an endless moment, his whiskers wilted, but then his small feet began to fidget and twitch, and his little legs began to swing. "What are you doing, Whiskers?" he asked them, but they had streamed down alongside his face, quite busy with their plan, and soon his legs were pumping wildly back and forth, and the great bird began to wobble above him. In the early wobbling, Dossie had the faint impression that his whiskers were trying to free him from the clutches of the bird, but as the wobble got wobblier and became a very precipitous rocking, Dossie understood. He took a gasping breath as the great woodpecker tipped off the table and splashed into the pool of blood below. Instantly, Dossie felt the bird's claw release him. There was a wave-making rustle of wings. With one paw, Dossie held tight to Unwith. The worm stiffened at the startling thick cold of the liquid. The moment the worm awoke, Dossie's mind flooded to the brim with several levels of understanding. "It's all right, Mr. Unwith," he said, in a confident tone that he hoped might calm the shivering worm. He scrambled his tail for the saggy balloon, and then crawled across its sinking, baggy softness. "Let the duck take you, WYSIWYG," Dossie ordered. "We're going back to Meadowlark." The bird's stunned face was drenched in puddle blood, but he stopped flapping away from the duck assaulting at his wings. Another curling emission of blood erupted as duck and woodpecker went shooting down into the blood. Dossie closed his eyes and stretched out a reluctant paw as he'd seen the little girl and old woman do. "Am I awake?" Unwith cried out, struggling to emerge from his wormy fog of sleep. "We are travelling now to Meadowlark," Dossie whispered. "By duck, Mr. Unwith." The duck clamped its beak around his paw, and he felt a sharp tug. And just as they began their downward voyage into the heavy murk, Dossie stabbed his claws into the saggy skin beneath him. He didn't know why, but his whiskers did, that Kittery Embers would need it, would need the dropsied skin.
"Ever desperate wandering in the wind, all the monks of Ball is here. Soldiers sing. We'll be right back.
They did not go down to see the ocean. The way was too rocky for her mother's chair, and the wind too fast and frigid from the beach. Instead, they stood in a line of three on the promontory and gazed down at the crashing waves until a lone bell called them back to the house for lunch. When her parents had finally driven off, Kittery was permitted a long moment to acquaint herself with the house. After leaving her things in her new room with its high bed and lace covers, Kittery made her way along the carpets and back halls of the mansion, with Mrs. Brushes following close behind. Even in the bright twilight of the early afternoon, the house was dark. There was a sound of leaking air from the nearby ocean that penetrated every wall. Muffled chimes rang from rooms that could not be entered. Doors were locked, and lights were dimmed. Mrs. Brushes said very little during the tour, except to remark on things which could not be done, or things that should not be changed. Several times, as Kittery turned the iron knob of a heavy hall door, Mrs. Brushes pulled her roughly back, saying, "The rooms that are locked cannot be entered." In the library, where the severe dark prevented the reading of even the largest book title, Kittery searched for and found a rheostat. But Mrs. Brushes grabbed her hand before she could turn it. "The lights are to remain set at the quarter mark," she said. That first night, Kittery sat with her grandfather before a small television. They ate a ham dinner from tin trays. Mrs. Brushes laid a starched napkin over her lap, and she was told to remain in her seat until her food was gone and the tray removed. Periodically, her grandfather would change the channel or decrease the volume from a controller mounted on the side of his wheelchair until they were watching a soundless blur of film in black and white. "It wasn't an easy birth," he said, wiping his chin with his thumb and wrist. It was the first thing he'd said to her all day. In fact, it was the first thing he'd ever said to her. "She was in bed for most of the pregnancy. Did you know that?" Kittery did not. Locked in the prison of her tin tray and napkin, she looked into the darkness of the kitchen for some sign of Mrs. Brushes. "She's my only daughter, and so I'm quite familiar with the details, and I may be forgiven my anger," the minister said. "It is a situation of recurring hemorrhage and infection. Septicemia is what they call it. Quite curiously, I battle it myself, though with greater success. The liability is in our blood, Kittery, so you might remember the term. She nearly died when you arrived. I'm certain they would never tell you this, but you should know it. Know who you are and how you arrived. There's no good pretending otherwise. Like a bomb, you were exploded inside her." The old man turned his body from the flickering white film, a glued mass of bones. "And there's not been a moment's end to the bleeding," he continued. "I nearly killed my own mother in the same fashion. All these recurrences and returns. Facts of our blood, Kittery. What happened to me will happen to you. You will one day live in this house and have what I have and do what I did. Whether you care to believe it or not, your footsteps have each one been taken for you. The world, the ocean, shall be yours as it was for me. One day nurses will push you down into your chair, though you can still stand. Look into my face and see yourself. The same eyes and mouth, the same skin." He reached a hand through the darkness, like a dead snake from a hole in the wall, and his fingers bit down into her shoulder like poison fangs. "The same blood, the same flesh," he said, sinking his fingers deeper. "Who did it?" he inquired of the air, as though a universal question that anyone could ask. "Who did it, Kittery, is what I aim to remind you of. What have you done to your mother, to my daughter, to me then, and to your father?" She could not breathe in the weight of it. All of it locked her in place, the tin tray and napkin and the burden of his poisoned hand and the rearrangement of the damage to her mother, from the mystery of the outside world directly to her own body. "Who did it?" he asked again, without even trying, who did it. He loomed closer, and to make him stop, because his way was never to stop, she said it.
I did, she whispered.
He smiled to one side, and she felt his flesh wash over her, a dropping of heavy cold skin.
We both did, he hissed in her ear. Just imagine what terrible things you could do if you put your mind to it.
She raised her arms against the skin that fell, but her eyes were elsewhere and her strength was gone. There was a white glowing rain above her grandfather's face and the dark line of the forest and the pining frost of the stars. The woodpecker flew in over the trees, an exhausted contraption of feathers and fur, and found her where she stood upon his back. Her arms were raised in the dream of her resistance as Dossie set the saggy skin over her hands. It slid down her length with rippling acceptance, her brand new, her most old, outfit. With a cavernous and croaking voice, she called out the rule as it appeared in her mind.
To find out deepest what's within, where your oldest last, and drops its skin.
I walk down the path through the woods, the falling snow, my neighbor, black as ice. A silver dream as we go skating down the stream. Available as an ebook for Kindle and other ebook reading devices for 99 cents. Search for Kittery Embers on Amazon.com or visit SherwinSleeves.com or RadioGhost.com for more information. The audio chapters will continue to be available for free. Thank you, my friends.